Good morning, everyone. Last week, we talked about man being made to the image and likeness of God. And now we're going to talk about the second part of that declaration from God about let him have dominion over the animals, over the sea, over the creatures of the sea, the creatures of the land. Let man have dominion over these things. So what does that phrase mean? And we're centering on this reading from St. Gregory of Nyssa. Remember last week, we talked about how it is that St. Basil, St. Gregory of Nyssa, St. Gregory Nazianzen, these are what we call the three Cappadocian fathers, and St. Basil is the older brother of St. Gregory of Nyssa. St. Basil writes this work on the 6 days, the Hexameron, and what we're reading from Gregory of Nyssa on the making of man, is usually how that's translated, workmanship of man or the making of man. This is the continuation of Basil's work that Gregory carries out. So it's as if you're thinking of the work of the 6 days. That's most of what would be Genesis chapter 1. And St. Gregory of Nyssa is taking that kind of end of chapter 1, being made to the image and likeness, and carrying that through into chapter 2. One of the things that was raised earlier as a question, when Moses was in the desert, if we're going to believe that Moses wrote down his revelation, well, he's not out there with pencil and paper. How is he writing these things down? It's true, when we think of paper, the first things we think of are papyrus. In other words, you're taking leaves and you're beating them flat. So you're coming up with some kind of vegetable-based writing materials. And that's, of course, what paper is. Paper is made from wood pulp, where it's a plant-based thing to write on. But you have to remember, what was more common was not people using things like that. What was more common was people writing on dried skins, dried animal skins, or writing on what's called vellum, where you have animal skins that have been treated, so essentially like writing on leather. Those were the things that people could write on if they didn't have something that was plant-based. And so if Moses is going around the desert, as long as he's got animals to kill, dry their skins, he's got something to write on. Okay? So that was something that was very common to use as something on which to, you know, keep your records, or you roll this thing up, you dry these things, you roll them up, and that's what your scrolls were fashioned from. It's true, like papyrus, this is going to decompose after a while. So the Dead Sea Scrolls, which we found, the reason that they lasted so long, they were kept in underground in this sealed chamber, discovered entirely by accident, and the climate is warm but dry. If you have a climate that's moist, then you're going to escalate decomposition. But you're able to keep things relatively cool and particularly dry, then things are going to last longer. But remember, as these things decompose, like as these sacred texts decompose, they're recopied. And the recopying procedure was very rigorous. If you were in the middle of a page or a scroll and you made a mistake, you had to start over again. They just scratched that and started from the beginning. So there was this discipline to make sure that you were copying accurately and you were tracking the accuracy of what you were doing, and you just weren't putting up with mistakes. You'd have variations in text, but by and large, this was pretty effective as a means of carrying on something written in a way that was faithful to the original. So I just wanted to give you that background in case you're wondering. Here's Moses around the desert. How does he get a revelation to record if he doesn't have paper? If he's got animals and you can get skins out of them, you can write on the skins or treat the skins, and you've got vellum. Okay, first thing that I want to talk about with regard to our reading. There's a chapter before. I didn't want to give you too much in the St. Gregory of Nyssa. But if you look at chapter 4, Gregory will talk about how it is that man being made to the image and likeness of God, that he is being made a kind of king over nature. And right, God himself is the Lord of the universe. He's the king of the universe. So man being made to his image, there's a way in which he shares in that kingship. Now, when we think of that kingship, of course, we're going to talk about him being the king of natural beings, of having exercising a kind of lordship over plants and over animals. But one of the ways that he's going to do this is the way that he does it in himself. Right, all of us in ourselves have things that are like the animals or like the plants. We all have these natural desires for food and drink and survival and pleasure and so on. So one of the first ways that man shares in this kingship is the rule that he has over himself, that he is temperate or brave or just. These are ways in which he is ruling over himself and ruling over nature within himself. So please remember last year when we read, I think it was the second letter of Peter. Peter will talk about how it is that in Christ we have been made a priestly people, right? We have been made a priestly people. So on the one hand, Christ is the true priest. He is the one who offers the perfect sacrifice to the Father, and he himself is the perfect victim. But on the other hand, we share in that sacrifice, share in that priesthood, insofar as we carry out something like that sacrifice within ourselves. And the way that the Church Fathers will talk about it, that we offer up our will, that we submit ourselves to the will of God and sacrifice our own will. Think about the model that our Lord offers in his agony in the garden. Not my will, but thine be done. That all of us can do that within ourselves. And in following the model, we are in a way making a sacrifice of ourselves. Now, of course, that sacrifice is only an imitation, only shares in the perfect sacrifice of Christ. But it's precisely because it shares in that it's elevated. Grace within us makes us a kind of priest. Not the fullness of the priesthood that you have in Christ or that you have in his ordained priesthood, but modeled in it insofar as his grace allows us more and more perfectly to offer a sacrifice of our will. There are these gifts or offices. Offices are the more common way that you hear it. This threefold office of Christ: Christ prophet, Christ priest, and Christ king. So last year when we talked about this letter of St. Peter, we were talking about the priestly office of Christ. But here, if you look at chapter 4, earlier than what we read is from chapter 7, but earlier in chapter 4, this is what addresses the kingly office. Just as our Lord is the Lord of creation, he made all things come through him. We are meant to be the lords of nature, and that starts within ourselves. When we are controlling our desires, our emotions, especially as those emotions and desires may work against reason, that we rule them. And again, especially sharing in that grace, that divine life in us, that makes us a king. We are sharing in that kingly office that Christ exemplifies. Let him have dominion over the earth, over the creatures, and so on. When we see that word dominion, one of the things I asked you in your discussion questions, that can imply subjugation. It can imply, if I think of a caricature from my childhood, the Lorax from Dr. Seuss. If just picture like these machines with axes, going around and cutting down all the trees. What are those called? The truffula trees. And all the factories are belching smoke. And all the barbalutes with their barbalute suits, right? They all walk off because there isn't anything to live on anymore. All the lakes are polluted and the sky is clouded. There are no more truffula trees. Okay? If you read Genesis and your idea of man's dominion over nature looks like that, that isn't anything that you're going to get out of the text, because you've got to bear with it the whole greater context. It isn't simply man has mastery over nature. The idea there is that man is made to the image and likeness of God and therefore is answerable to God for how it is that he treats the world. So instead of thinking about it in terms of dominion, mastery, simply sort of almost like selfish or dominating control of nature, a more helpful term to use is stewardship. Now, I realize when if I use the word stewardship, you're going to think, he's going to pass around the basket, or we're going to get envelopes asking for a contribution. No, not that kind of stewardship. The idea of stewardship is that you are managing something that you don't own. So, especially for our students, usually our female students, who are Jane Austen aficionados, I will talk about how it is that Darcy, when Darcy is living at Pemberley, and here he is, he's bringing in 20,000 pounds a year in income. Well, Darcy is not like hiring the groundskeepers or necessarily managing the books, or he's not patrolling the place. That is something that he's going to hire somebody for that. How are you going to go off and, you know, hang out with Bingley in London if you've got to kind of do the day-to-day work of your estate? No. That's what the estate manager does. Maybe he's called an estate manager, maybe he's called a bailiff, but the more common term tended to be steward. When you were a steward, you managed property that was not your own. And so when we talk about a stewardship of the land, a stewardship of the earth, you will hear sometimes in Catholic churches environmental stewardship. The idea is that we are managing things that ultimately belong to God. And so, therefore, we are answerable to Almighty God for how it is we care for the earth. So you wouldn't be able to get out of that, we can simply do to the earth whatever we feel like. No, there are ways in which the earth and plants and animals are meant to sustain human beings, are for our sake. But to say that they're for our sake doesn't mean that they're at our will. We are ultimately answerable to the Lord who made it and who gave it to us as a gift for us to sustain ourselves, yes, but that we're answerable to Him in how we do that. When I was a teenager, I remember at one point my father just walked in my room. And I was so annoyed by this. I said, "You just walked in my room. You didn't even knock or anything." My father says, "Oh, I walked in your room. Come here, son." And why? Well, he took me out to the living room, took me out where the roll top desk was, and he pulls out this drawer and lays out this folder on his desk. It's the title to the house. And he says, "Son, I'm looking here. I don't see your name on this title. I see my name. That room that you're calling your room is my room, just like every room in this house is my room." Okay? Yeah. I was kind of pouty after that. But the point, of course, he was making, I thought of it as my room because I was in it all the time and my stuff was in it all the time. And I wasn't thinking of the part that, well, no, I'm using that room. Ultimately, it belongs to my father, and I'm here for a while, but, you know, in another couple of years, I'll be off at college. By By the way, when I went off to college, my parents actually moved, and then I lost the room. I was actually rooming with my younger brother who was still at home. I didn't have a room anymore. That showed me. We can think of things that are our own simply because we use them all the time or we have them all the time. And that's true of our own property as adults. And it's also true the way that we can think about the land, the earth, which God has given to us. It's not ours to simply do with us as we please. Now, one of the things that I will address in a future talk, in the early 1960s, there was a historian, culture historian, at the University of California, Berkeley, Lynn White. Lynn White wrote a short but very influential essay called The Roots of Our Ecological Crisis. And White's thesis was that the origin of our mistreatment of the earth goes back to Genesis. It goes back to seeing man as superior to nature. For White, he thought the ecological mentality was that we are beings, as it were, with nature or in nature. The moment that we see ourselves above nature, we are simply going to exploit the earth. We're simply going to mistreat it. And at least here we can give a kind of an initial response to White that what Genesis offers is true. We are over nature. But we are not over nature without anything above us. We are over nature precisely because we are sharing in that source. We are sharing in the Creator in this very unique way. We have a Creator who made the world according to wisdom and according to love. And we share in that wisdom and love in the way that the rest of animals don't. In fact, if we want to talk about ecological responsibility, how can there be responsibility if we aren't somehow beings above nature? If we aren't beings that don't have knowledge and will? It's a little hard to understand how you could be responsible if you are really just part of nature. We can only be addressed as being irresponsible, failing responsibility, if we're beings that are in fact above nature. Again, I don't want to lose the point that one of the first ways that we are that we're exercising our dominion, this kingship that St. Gregory talks about, is within ourselves. That the first way that we're governing nature is governing nature within us. That we're regulating our own desires, our own emotions. There's a wonderful discussion that C.S. Lewis has in this book, Miracles, that the seniors read. Whenever reason acts on nature, what reason can do is elevate nature. So that you're sitting there with clothes and washed bodies and trim nails in a house that's or a building that's protecting you and keeping you warm, right? Those are all ways that reason has acted on nature. That reason is serving nature within yourself, keeping you clean and healthy and warm and protecting you and so on. It doesn't work the other way. Whenever nature, as it were, acts on reason, it doesn't elevate reason, it tends to eliminate or destroy reason. When nature is acting on you in a way that overcomes reason, think about it. You're dizzy or sleepy or intoxicated or anxious or whatever. All of these things are ways in which nature is overcoming reason. And when nature overcomes reason, reason doesn't work. Reason can elevate nature. But nature doesn't by itself improve reason. When nature rules, it's sort of like having the inmates running the asylum. So last week, when I was talking about providence, divine providence, and I raised this school of thought from the ancient world, the Epicureans. By the way, I had the question. Well, when I've heard the expression Epicurean, I usually associate that with someone who's pleasure-seeking. In fact, there are these websites out there, Epicurus, I think, is one of them, and it's actually a cooking website. It's a website with all sorts of great recipes, you know, high cuisine. No, the idea from Epicurus is that the world is all atoms in motion. So it's materialist. Everything is what it is because of these atoms that make it up. And there's a denial that there's any kind of God or divine power. And there's a denial, therefore, that the world is ordered according to some kind of plan. Things are the way they are because they've developed that way by the necessary movement of the atoms and then chance arrangements. Okay? So the reason that Epicurean develops into this meaning of being a hedonist or a pleasure seeker, because Epicurus, acting as a kind of materialist, he thinks that the only two real things out there are pleasure and pain, right? So there, he doesn't believe in spiritual perfections or perfections of soul. He thinks, nope, the only things that are real are pleasure and pain. So you want to maximize forms of pleasure, minimize forms of pain. Maximize pleasure, by the way, did not mean being self-indulgent. You indulge in alcohol, you're going to have a hangover in the morning. You indulge in sweets, you're going to get adult onset diabetes. No, so there was a kind of temperance that an Epicurean could have, but it was because an Epicurean was trying to spare himself pain. It wasn't because he was acting according to some kind of virtue. Now, the reason we brought that up last week is because we have all grown up with an evolutionary view of animals and plants that they are the way they are because they developed by chance over time. Now, that is supported or argued using field biology and using fossils and using genetics and so on. The basic idea, however, that animals and plants are what they are because they developed by chance, that is not a new idea. That's you can get that in Epicurus. Also, if you read Lucretius, we don't really have direct texts of Epicurus. We have things that are really attributed to him. Epicureanism had the punch it did in the ancient world largely due to this Latin writer, Lucretius, who writes this work on the nature of things. And it had a big comeback in the Renaissance. There are a number of early modern writers who, as they're starting to think through their rebellion against Christianity and providence, they go back to Lucretius. But Epicureanism here doesn't mean hedonism or pleasure seeking. It means believing that you are in a universe that's fundamentally materialist, and if there's any kind of apparent order, that's largely the result of chance. By the way, Epicureans would deny free will. If you read Lucretius, he will say that free will is really a form of atomic swerve. It's the atoms at points moving at random. And we think that's freedom, but really it's just atomic swerve. Now, I want to introduce this other line of thinking that also existed in the ancient world, Stoicism. Stoicism, it's named after the Stoa. This was this pillar where its early teachers would speak from. Zeno, I think, is one of the early teachers here. The idea of Stoicism was that you are in an ordered universe. They don't believe in the gods exactly as they come out of Homer and how they come out of maybe the Virgil, but they've got this idea of their being, that they're higher beings, that they work according to a plan, and that they expect us to be dutiful and virtuous. The Stoics, if they one of the conflicts they have with Christianity, these were folks who thought that you shouldn't live in a way in which you think that you're going to feel good about doing good. You shouldn't be pained by things that are you shouldn't be pained by evils. You shouldn't be delighted by things that are good. In other words, they were cultivating what was called apatheia. Now, we look at that word and we think apathy, and we just think you're bored. But the idea for them of apatheia was that you try to be detached from your emotions. Almost like, if you're old Star Trek fans, almost like Mr. Spock, where you think the good path is freeing yourself from emotion. Now, what does that have to do with what we're talking about here? Epicureans would have denied order in nature. That's just an appearance. But the Stoics actually thought that you lived in an ordered universe. And so there was a compatibility, there was a fittingness between what the Stoics believed and what it is that Christians believed. So you can get all sorts of spirited criticism of Christianity in the early church from people who had who were formed by Epicureanism. You can get some number of people who were formed in Stoicism who actually come into Christianity. There is this compatibility between the two, and periodically Stoics would come over because they recognized that Christianity had a lot of the things they believed in, duty and virtue and a divine order that was that was behind it. Conversely, there are people who are Christians who pick up things like Epictetus, what's called the handbook, or probably more commonly, Marcus Aurelius, the Meditations, and they can recognize similarities between what's there. The fundamental similarity in terms of what we're addressing, they recognize that they live in an ordered providential universe, that the divine cares for man, the divine cares for creation, the divine cares for the good of the whole. And so when you're living a good life, you are living it in obedience to an order that's been set out by the divine. Okay. Now, last time we were talking about providence with regard to plants and animals. So now I'd like to address that with regard to human beings. Because the Epicureans would criticize Christians on the grounds that they believed in a God that plainly was not acting providentially when it came to the human race. Okay, there are two folks you can read this in. Origen. Origen, remember, writes in the 3rd century, in the middle of the 200s. We're gonna see some Origen later on. And then Lactantius. Origen is an Eastern father, that is, he's writing in Greek. Lactantius is an African father, North Africa, same region as St. Augustine, and he writes in Latin. But Origen, in a treatise which is called Against Celsus, or Celsus, you'll say it with a C, sometimes you'll hear it Celsus, sometimes you'll hear it Celsus. Celsus raises this Epicurean objection. All the animals have come into the world and they're born with the things that allow them to survive. They have claws, they have stingers or wings, they're fast, or they can fly or whatnot. But human beings come into the world with nothing. They come into the world defenseless. They can be the victims of all the other animals. Why is it you would think that there's something special about man, when man is the one who appears to be the most deprived? Okay, that's the objection. We have, in fact, this phrase that's attributed to Epicurus. We have it in Lactantius because he's right articulating the Epicurean objection. And the way it goes is, nature is not a mother. Nature, rather, is a stepmother. Now, of course, there are very, very loving stepmothers out there. We don't just want to fall into stepmother stereotypes. As he writes that, though, it's like what you want to picture is like every stepmother you've ever read in fairy tales. Think of like Cinderella. So it's as if it's not Mother Earth. It's not something which is nurturing and caring for you. No, it's always like the wicked stepmother in Cinderella, that you're getting locked up and you're not going to the ball. You are having whatever blessings have been given to you taken away or thwarted, right? That's the way that nature is, right? And both Origen and Lactantius will take on this objection. Origen will point out it's the very fact that we don't have these things naturally. We don't have fins or wings or claws or fangs or stingers, that we have to develop these. We have to develop things instead. We have to invent. If you think, for example, about the Greek myth of Epimetheus and Prometheus. Maybe it's been a while since you picked up your Greek mythology. But remember the story about these two gods. Epimetheus hands out all these gifts to all the animals. All these things like I've been talking about. Feathers and wings and stingers and right ability to bounce to kangaroos and build dams to beavers and rattle to the rattlesnakes. Right? He hands all these things out. But by the time he gets to man, it's like the shelves are empty. He's used up all the gifts, and man has nothing. And here's man, just as Epicurus describes him, vulnerable to all the animals, helpless. And it's, remember, Prometheus that comes along and steals fire from the gods to give to man. And that's what allows man to survive. That's a wonderful image, is it not? Because that fire, it's not just the physical fire. The idea behind it is human beings have reason. They have mind. They can take things in their environment, like fire, and use them as a tool. And this is the point that Origen makes. It's precisely man's neediness that forces him to develop all of the various arts. So to develop horsemanship, to hunt with dogs, to get your wool from sheep, all of these things man has to invent and develop. So if you think about the myth of Prometheus, that you steal fire from the gods, it's as if reason that man has is something that the divine is jealous of. It's that they're trying to keep it from you. And in fact, it then sets up this kind of conflict between the gods and man. Prometheus, of course, is punished for giving fire to man, from taking it from heaven. But in Genesis, this ability that man has to think, to speak, that gives him power over the animals, this very thing is God's gift. God is a loving father. This isn't contrary to Lactantius's understanding of Epicurus, where nature is a stepmother. God is a loving father who's given us these abilities, and now the very need that we have forces them to develop. It is our need that is the origin of the arts. The may be helpful if you think about the very word for art in Greek. The word for art in Greek is techne, like technology. Technology develops because we have environments that are hostile, like Minnesota in the winter. And so we're forced to develop all sorts of things that will continue to allow us to eat, to live, to work. So that you are not simply having it, as it were, dumped on you in abundance, that does not mean that God is unloving, uncaring, improvident. In fact, it could be as a parent. There are these times that you really need to support and provide and so on, but sometimes the very way that you need to support is by pulling back and forcing your child to realize their own need. That there has to be something where the kid really does have to reach in within themselves. There's a story about Duke Ellington. His mom was really devoted to him. He was an only child. And they asked him, well, how loving was your mom? Was your mom a loving mom? And Duke Ellington says, my mom never let my feet touch the ground. That can be a beautiful thing. And certainly didn't stop him from being a wonderful musician. But that can also be a kind of a crippling thing if you're not able to figure out for yourself, especially in tough circumstances. That's always the battle as you're raising a kid and they're getting older. How much of it do you leave for them to figure out themselves? And when do you have to just come in and kind of bail them out? But the point I'm making here is that it's precisely because of man's need that he develops reason in the ways that produce the abundance of the arts. I'll talk about this more next week. It doesn't hurt to mention it now. when Aristotle, for example, writing before Christianity, talks about the human body, he will talk about the fittingness of hands for beings that have reason. You know, what would your dog do with hands? It'd be pretty disturbing, actually, if your dog had hands. But you've got to have reason. Anaxagoras, I think it was, there were these early Greek materialists who said that man has reason because he has hands. And Aristotle says, no, it's the opposite. He has hands because he has reason. Hands are the tool of tools. They are not only a tool for using tools, they're a tool for making tools. The term in Greek, organa, organum, right? The tool of tools. So it's reason that allows the hand to become a shovel or a sword or rope, allows them to become these things at will. It's true, we can't fly, but we can build planes or hang gliders and fly. It's true that we can only stay in the water for so long, but we can build boats, and that will carry us over the water. It is true that we don't have stingers or fangs, but we can have knives or swords or muskets or rifles. So it's reason that allows us to create these things and allows us then to dominate our environments. So in conclusion here, last week we were talking about providence governing animals, and what we've been looking at here, starting with this text from St. Gregory of Nyssa, is the way in which providence governs human beings. Providence has placed us in a position of dominion over the animals. And as we saw here in Gregory, what this means is that animals complete our life. Our life, in a way, depends on them. They've been put here for us to provide for ourselves. But the reason that is because we are beings made to the image and likeness of God. We are beings with mind. We're beings with will. So we adapt the natural world to ourselves in a way that the animals and plants do not. And that, again, doesn't mean that we are simply, that we do it at will. We can do it in any way we please. The fact that we are made to the image and likeness of God means that we are ultimately answerable to the source. We are ultimately answerable to the Lord that made us. So next week, we will talk about the fittingness of the human body, another wonderful reading from St. Gregory of Nyssa. So see you next week.